Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Last month, the National Endowment for the Arts, in partnership with the National Council for the Traditional Arts, honored their latest National Heritage Fellows with a virtual event that featured a wide range of culturally diverse artists. The National Heritage Fellowship is a lifetime honor presented to between 9 and 15 master folk and traditional artists each year, recognizing not just their artistic excellence, but also their ongoing contributions to our nation's traditional arts heritage. These extraordinary individuals come from diverse communities throughout the country, representing some of the finest artists in the nation. Among this year's recipients are two incredible artists from central and northern Wisconsin. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Today, we meet some artists who were named National Fellows and have spent much of their lives sharing their work and preserving the cultural identity of their communities, passing their techniques and traditions on to the next generation. In a little bit, we'll work to connect with Wayne Valier of the Lac du Flambeau Ojibwe. He is one of just a handful of birch bark canoe builders left in the United States. But for now, we're going to be speaking with Karen Ann Hoffman of the Oneida Nation. She is a raised bead worker who lives in Stevens Point and a respected leader in her art, now an NEA National Heritage Fellow. Karen Ann, thank you so much for being here, and congratulations on this incredible honor. You must be just so amazing. You must be so pleased.
I'm pleased. I am pleased, Shereen. I'm pleased for this opportunity to talk about Native art and the importance of it in the state of Wisconsin and beyond. But I'm really pleased to receive this fellowship as a representative for all those outstanding Native artists across the country. There is no shortage of talent in Indian country, no shortage at all. So thank you for this opportunity. Thank you to my fellow artists for allowing me to represent. And I'm delighted to be here today.
Well, we're delighted to have you. Tell us a little bit more about the significance of the award for people who might not be familiar with it.
Well, it feels a little uncomfortable to toot my own horn, but what they do say is that the NEA National Heritage Fellow is our nation's highest honor for the traditional arts. And among the people who have received this in the past are such luminaries as Maya Angelou and B.B. King. And to be in the company of those kinds of really stellar artists and human beings is deeply humbling. I did make notes of three things that I would like to say. And so if I might, Shereen, before I forget them.
Sure.
Thanks. The first thing I wanted to do was to congratulate Wayne on being named a 2020 NEA Heritage Fellow and to thank him publicly for all that he does to preserve and to share his culture through traditional arts. I am deeply grateful to Wayne, and congratulations on this honor. The second thing is that I would like Wisconsin to know that it's extremely rare for two artists to be named National Heritage Fellows from the same state in the same year. I cannot think of a time that that has happened before. I think that I'd like to extrapolate and say that that's a result of Wisconsin's support for the arts in general and Native arts perhaps in particular. And I just want to thank the people of Wisconsin for all that they do to support the arts in all its forms across our state. And the final third thing I want to say, Shereen, is I want to personally and publicly thank Dr. Ann Pryor. She's the past Wisconsin State folklorist. She was the person who nominated me and shepherded my year-long nomination process through all the trials and tribulations. I would say that if it were not for her particular skills and kindness and generosity, I would not be sitting here talking to you today. So none of this happens because of an individual. It all happens, Shereen, because of community. So that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Listeners, your questions are welcome, too. You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-780-9742. You can email us as well, route51@wpr.org. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. I'm really interested in how you got started. Who were your first teachers, and how old were you when you began learning this craft?
Thank you for the opportunity to share about this. So I grew up in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. I'm the daughter of a Ruggierian father and a Rubenesque mother. So I was raised to be involved in the humanities. I was raised with an appreciation for art, but I was not a beater until I went away to college and started meeting other Native gals of my age. And it's kind of what you did in the 80s. You made some kind of pan-Indian beaded earrings or maybe a bracelet, something that wasn't really culturally specific, but at that time felt Indian to us. And so we did that. Well, that's the 80s, and it comes to be the 90s, and I see an advertisement in my local tribal newspaper, the Galawisux. And in the Galawisux, it says, come to a Haudenosaunee raised beadwork workshop given by Samuel Thomas and his mother, the late Lorna Hill. Samuel Thomas has been my teacher from that day to this. Lorna Hill, although she no longer walks on this earth, is still my teacher, and I would not disappoint either one of them for all the money in the world. I'm grateful to them for teaching me an authentic art, a culturally specific art, but more than just the stitches, the reasons behind, and the responsibility for those stitches.
We'll be bringing Wayne in shortly, but as we work to do that, Karen Ann, explain your artwork. Tell us, we can't see it. We're right on the radio. So explain to our listeners, what does it look like?
Well, first of all, imagine the most gorgeous thing you've ever seen.
So of course.
Start with that. But there is no doubt, Haudenosaunee raised beadwork is just that. It's beadwork which is raised, piled, embossed, three-dimensional above the substrate. Now, the substrate that I use is the very best velvet that I can find. The beads that I use are high-quality Czechoslovakian glass that glitter and shine and have a personality all their own. My other two tools are a steel needle and a bit of cotton thread with some beadwax on it. With those really simple materials, I work as hard as I can to stitch our past into our present and lay a foundation for those whose faces we have not yet seen. The objects that I make range from, I won't say small because I'm known for working in a broad, large scale, but they range from flat two-dimensional objects to three-dimensional objects, rocking chairs, beaded urns, those kinds of things. But every one of them tells a tradition with those simple materials. I was believe, and I'll just finish this, Shireen, and that my job as a beater is to take my ego and set it aside. The important thing is the transmission of tradition and to let the objects transmit that tradition and make all the decisions about size, shape, and color. It's all up to the culture. I'm simply a vehicle.
I'd like to ask you more about the history behind this beadwork. This is something that has a long and rich tradition to your people. Yes. Can you tell us about that?
So Haudenosaunee raised beadwork is a material art form of the people of the Eastern Great Lakes. So I'm Oneida in our original homeland. If you think about the Niagara Falls, you're kind of in the area. We've been working with the same forms, design, and motifs for the past 10, 12, 14,000 years. The shapes and symbols that I still use today, I've seen etched in shell and scratched in stone in objects that are dated to be 2,000, 3,000, and 4,000 years old. This link, unbroken chain of culture, gets expressed with different materials over time. Originally, stone, shell, later, moose hair, moose hide, now velvet and Czechoslovakian glass beads, but the transmission of the culture never changes.
I know that you're passionate about Native American art in general. That certainly came out in just these few minutes that we've been talking. How were you drawn to raised beadwork as an artistic calling? What led you to this particular type of craft?
I'm fond of saying that I didn't choose raised beadwork, that raised beadwork chose me. I had no choice in the matter. It is, to me, the perfect vehicle at this time to express that unbroken link between the past, present, and the future. When I pick up a needle and thread and I'm working with those beads and that velvet, I'm at an intersection of time where the past, the present, and the future exist all at once in that self-same stitch. There is no linear description of time like you might see on a timeline in a geography book. What there is a community of Haudenosaunee, all those who have ever existed, all of us who currently exist, and all those faces we have yet to see, all exist in that same stitch at that same time. I didn't choose that magic. That magic allowed me into its realm.
You talked about some of the elements of your artwork, the Czech glass beads and the calico lining. How do those reflect a relationship between Oneida culture and other cultures? You're blending. Is that intentional?
There is nothing that I do that is not intentional. There are no accidents or happenstance in the design of my work. For example, the use of calico as a lining for the velvet goes back to the earliest interactions of the Haudenosaunee with the Dutch. And at the time that we signed a treaty, agreed to share our land with the Dutch, we gifted them something called a two-row wampum, and they gifted us calico. Nowadays, we use that calico on the backside of our beadwork, and this is what it says. The velvet on top with that clearly Haudenosaunee beadwork, that's us. The calico underneath, that represents our neighbors. And when you fuse the two of them together, that's a symbol that two cultures can live side by side, respecting one another, not changing one another, encouraging one another, but living together with one another in harmony and not in strife. That was the message of two-row wampum. That's the message that we use when we line our beadwork with the gift of the Dutch, the calico, even yet today. The hope that cultures can live together and support one another without feeling the need to change the other.
You're listening to National Heritage Fellow Karen Ann Hoffman, our guest today on Route 51. We are hoping to connect with Wayne Ballier as well for a discussion on the work and traditions they are working to hand down to the next generation of artists in their communities. Your questions and comments are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shireen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Siewert. Karen Ann Hoffman is with us today. She is a National Heritage Fellowship Award winner, here to talk about her work and efforts to keep this cultural tradition alive in her community. We hope to have Wayne Ballier with us a little bit later on in the program. If you have questions, you're welcome to join the conversation. You can email us at route51@wpr.org or call us at 800-780-9742. When calling, be sure to leave enough time for our producer to answer your call. Karen Ann, this has been just a wonderful conversation. And I have to wonder, you said you and your husband have built a life centered around Native American traditions. This is so central to your life. And I read an interview in which you mentioned that your husband's encouragement to attend a workshop was part of this journey that you have had. What happened next, and how have you changed and evolved since then?
Well, I want to thank you for mentioning my Michan, my Chiquanacut. He was central in allowing me to continue on this path. I told you that there was an article in my tribal newspaper. And I was ready to ignore that article until my husband said, "You must go. You really should go." And I was like, "No, it's a 2-hour drive to go to the workshop." But he insisted that I go. And from that moment, I became a neophyte raised beater. My Michan encouraged me every moment along the way. He is gone now. He's been gone for the last 2 years. But it was his support, his constant support along my journey that really allowed me to develop into the artist that I've become. I told you before that no one reaches any pinnacles without community. And I think that's particularly true of professional artists whose families are as deeply involved in the art as the artist themselves. We would not make this progress without the love and support of our families. And so my Michan, he was a Menominee language teacher. That was extremely important in our household. Our dogs all spoke Menominee, probably better than I do. We lived a subsistence lifestyle, although I won't call it subsistence because we're fat and sassy, but the food we ate, we grew, we hunted, or we foraged for ourselves by and large. We heated with wood, we pumped our water, we just lived a lifestyle that was very connected to the earth around us. And when I give my lecture, Shereen, I'm fond of saying that it's the environment that creates a culture. And it's that culture from which an art style springs. And so without the embrace of Mother Earth, our grandmother the moon, and our elder brother the sun, we would not have the materials that we need to inspire us and make us into artists.
I've read that beads have come to represent resiliency in some ways. These are not simple trinkets that we're talking about here. Can you explain how important those beads are, how important this art form is, and what those beads do represent from a cultural and spiritual perspective?
Well, I'm not sure what you read, and I know that everybody has their own opinion about how their art form resonates for them. But I would say for myself, beads, again, are the perfect vehicle to continue this unbroken chain of culture. But what I do with those beads is I try very hard to respond to current day issues in light of the cultural content that's been passed down to me for these past 12, 14,000 years. So when I think about things that are happening in the world today, I try to bead about those events in light of the cultural traditions that have been passed down to me. So again, it brings me back to that intersection of time. And that, I think, for myself, is what the bead represents, the past, the present, the future, and the potential of all those three things to be anything we want them to be, if we only engage in a thoughtful way.
Take me through the process. How do you choose a project? How do you begin? What happens?
You know, there's very few times that I've actually made a choice about these things. I think that sounds kind of silly in some ways, but the truth of it is, I'm compelled to respond to something. So, for example, I'm very proud that the Field Museum has recently taken in a few of my creations, and one in particular is a rocking chair, a child's 1880s wooden rocking chair that I saw walking through an antique mall one day. When I saw that rocking chair, that child's rocking chair, I knew in that instant that it was the perfect vehicle for beading the three symbols of the Haudenosaunee creation story. And so I didn't make any choices. It was there. But what I did do, because I feel it's important for me to be very responsible, is I spent a lot of time talking to my elders, talking to my clan mother, talking to people who really know these things, to make sure that I got my story right. And after I spent that year or more talking to them, begins the engineering. People do not give credit to the amount of science and engineering in Native art. So I begin with pattern making and experimentation and practice, and that adds another 2 or 3 months. And then after a year or 13 months, I finally start beading. And that process, because I am slow and I like to think thoughtful, will take another 6 or 8 months. But finally, the object, and I use that word advisedly, comes to life with an animacy, an intent, and a life that far transcends my own. And my only part in it is to hold that needle and thread and to be that link.
What goes through your mind when you're taking each stitch?
Sometimes what goes through my mind is a great nothingness. Sometimes what goes through my mind is music. Sometimes what goes through my mind is the repetition of the story. Sometimes what goes through my mind is the hugs and the kisses and the love of all those people who have helped me along the way. And sometimes, and a lot of the times, what goes through my mind is my responsibility to those who have not yet been born, to make sure that I do this right, honor what my elders have told me, and express it in a way that folks 100 years from now, 200 years from now, when my name has long been forgotten, and that's fine, when they look at these living legacy pieces, that they'll know something about Haudenosaunee art.
Who are the artists who you find inspiration with? And who do you look to really give you that sense of something to aspire to?
Well, as I've said, there is no shortage of talent in Indian country, and that talent goes from way, way back to current. But one of the best inspirations for me are old pieces. Not every old piece is animate, but there are some times when I can visit with old pieces that I feel like I can engage and learn from them. Recently, an elder in Wisconsin read a newspaper article about the fellowship. She had some old pieces of raised beadwork that she didn't know what to do with. And she reached out, contacted me, and gifted me with some Haudenosaunee raised beadwork from the late 1880s. I am learning so much from those objects and from the kindness and generosity of that woman who wanted those pieces returned to a community member. It's amazing to me, Shireen, the places and the people that these simple pieces of glass will connect me with. I am so lucky, so fortunate.
I wanted to ask you about a medicine bag that you mentioned that honors some scarlet fever victims. Tell me about that project.
Well, the bag that we're talking about isn't made yet, but the situation certainly is. It requires a bit of an investigation into Wisconsin's history, so bear with me for a moment. The only original nations to what is now called Wisconsin by many accounts are the Ho-Chunk, the Ho-Chunkra, and the Omat-Naumannawak, the Menominee people. Everybody else has come later. We all have migration stories. But by the late 1700s, early 1800s, there was significant Native populations who called Owiyeskosik home. And so it was home to a variety of Native peoples. When you start to get to the early and middle 1800s, you begin to see an influx of migrants from European nations and American-born Caucasians. As those settlers, let's call them, come into Wisconsin, there is massive displacement of the indigenous people who have called this place home for 1,000 or more years. That's the early 1800s. Now, let's fast forward to about 1860. By 1860, the town I live in, Pasipikinan, which is now called Stevens Point, had been traditional homeland to the Menominees for about 14,000 years. But by the middle 1800s, the Menominee had been evicted from this piece of their homeland. And there was a settlers community that existed on the banks of the Wisconsin River. Well, as that settlers community began to grow and expand, displaced natives found a home about 2 or 3 miles away in a temporary encampment. It was a group, history tells us, and the archaeological evidence tells us, that was made up of Menominee, Ho-Chunk, Potawatomi. More research needs to be done to find these details. But what we do know is that there was a scarlet fever outbreak in the settler community of Stevens Point that got passed into this native encampment. And although people were very ill in the settler community, it's also true that the natives in this encampment died. Some of the research says 20 people. Some says 30, 50, 70, 100. We don't know the exact number, but we do know that those natives that died of scarlet fever were buried on that encampment. We know that by the time the 1860s progresses a little bit further, the natives that were living in this area called Warren's Glen were no longer able to stay. They too were being pushed out. We know that they moved north to Big Bull Falls, but we tend to lose track of them. What we do know is that their dead remained behind. And so there is this area that is a Native burial from a scarlet fever outbreak in the 1860s. By the time you get to the 1880s, you see that by land records, all of the land around this area begins to sell. Stevens Point begins to expand, and this encampment is used for a quarry and a garbage dump. And what we know is that that area, that garbage dump, that Native burial site never sold. We have records of interviews with survivors of the period who say, of course, that land never sold. Everybody knew that it was the home of a graveyard. Well, time goes on. Fast forward to 1894 and through a series of land transfers, the Stevens Point Normal School opens on that burial ground. That Stevens Point Normal School, time goes forward, becomes the University of Wisconsin in Stevens Point. And so that University of Wisconsin Stevens Point is built on a Native burial. That calls to me in a way that I am compelled to react to. Personally, there's a piece of art that's fermenting in me and will come out to honor and acknowledge this situation. But on a broader level, a level that I have no idea what it looks like, I am compelled to ask the state, the university, and the Stevens Point community to ask Native Wisconsinites what our large community would like for an acknowledgement, a monument, a marker, a garden. I have no idea. But I want that question put to the survivors, to the descendants of these people who still lay in those graves that are daily, daily walked upon by the students, faculty, and staff at UWSP. So that's that bag that you're talking about.
I want to ask you more about the significance of the medicine bag. Right now, I'm going to see if we are able to connect with Wayne. Wayne, are you with us now?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Oh, technology is, it's on when it's on and it's way off when it's off.
Exactly. Welcome. This is Wayne Valier of the Lac du Flambeau Ojibwe. He is one of just a handful of birch bark canoe builders left in the United States, also a national fellow. Thank you for joining us, and I'm glad we were finally able to connect. Before we go to a break, I want to just first congratulate you on this incredible honor. And I would like to ask you to just tell me a little bit about how canoe building became so central to your life's work. I know that you have a vast artistic repertoire. So why canoe building?
Like the lady elder was just saying, I was raised in a traditional family. My earliest memory is of the forest. My earliest memory is of harvesting different. The Ojibwe people were hunter gatherers. We still live that lifestyle. We still live off the land up here. We harvest fish. We harvest venison. I was out last night using my torch last night harvesting walleye on the lakes on a local lake last night, practicing our traditional ways. So. Even though it's modern, we're in the modern spectrum today, we still practice our native value and our native ways. All of our philosophies and the things that we do are still pretty much intact. They're just done in a modern way.
And how does the birch tree and the canoe itself connect with the way of perceiving the world for the people of your culture?
Well, with the Anishinaabe, birch bark canoe played a central role in just about everything they did in three seasons, from spring, summer, fall. Our people are constantly moving to the food sources. In the fall, we'd use birch bark canoe to get to our rice beds where we harvest manomen, wild rice. Take canoes across the lake to the berry patches, canoe over to our wintering grounds. Being able to travel across the land much quicker by birch bark canoe is a good example. The waterways, you can't throw a rock in where I live and not hit a lake. There's 268 lakes on the Lac du Flambeau Indian Reservation. And so it's much easier to cross the land by birch bark canoe, by travel. You carry the canoe, it's only weighs 68 pounds. So you pick it up, carry it to the next lake, drop it in. Paddle across that lake nine miles, pick it up, carry it a mile, drop it in, paddle another 15 miles. So you can cross the land pretty fast. The birch bark canoe is, it was also used for a container at a time we call Iskigumazagewin, which is boiling down sap or making maple sugar. They used the birch bark canoe for a vessel to help hold their sap before they boiled it down. It was they used birch bark canoe as a temporary shelter as they traveled. These canoes carry culture. They carry lots of life and lots of experience of families and both the hunt, the chase, the fish, all of it. And it's just our way of life. And every stitch entwined with that birch bark canoe it speaks to Anikubichikananik, our ancestors, the ones that come before us. And what the elder was saying, Geondadazijig, the ones that are not yet born. That's what we keep these canoes going for.
You're listening to National Heritage Fellows Wayne Valier and Karen Ann Hoffman, our guests today on Route 51, for a discussion on their award-winning artwork, the inspiration behind it all, and the cultural knowledge they hope to convey to future generations through their work. Your questions and comments are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Karen Ann Hoffman and Wayne Valier are our guests today, both National Heritage Fellowship Award winners. They're here to talk about the art they create and the connection their work has with the culture in their communities. If you have questions for our guests, you're welcome to join. Email us at route51@wpr.org or call us at 800-780-9742. Karen Ann, I wanted to get back to a question I'd hoped to ask you when we were talking earlier about your project that will honor the Scarlet Fever victims who were buried in a mass grave on what is now the UW Stevens Point campus. Why a medicine bag?
For me, that's my personal piece of art that's growing out of this. For me, I've been visiting that site and praying at that site, singing at that site, feeding at that site for as long as I've known about it. And one of the ways for me that that's been shown to me to be done is with the use of a particular kind of a bag. And so that expression is what I'm compelled to do right now. It's not the only way to honor these folks. But it is the way that speaks to me. This bag will be something that I think those ancestors from that time would recognize. They would have possibly used something similar. And I hope that they'll know that I care about them by the making of it. It's all about
earlier we talked about Karen Ann's process. And how she begins a project. Wayne, I'd like to ask you about that. I would imagine you begin by choosing the right tree. And how does it all start?
Gathering the materials for a birch bark canoe is first of all, we don't go by our time. We go by Nokomisikiminon's time, our grandmother, the Earth's time. When she's ready, that's when we harvest the materials for birch bark. Birch bark canoe building. In the springtime, when the rind is coming off the trees, that's in June of the year is when we get the best bark. It pops off the tree. In the fall time, we get watabin, which are spruce roots that are harvested. And also in the early spring, we get bigu, pitch for our sealant for the canoes. And in Bibun, winter time, when the swamps are frozen, we're able to go into the swamps and harvest gishik, which is cedar, the wood for all the framework of the birch bark canoe. So it's a seasonal thing that we, in each season, you have to wait till that season comes, harvest that material. After you get all that material done, then the work is just began. First of all, to locate a tree that's 16 inches in diameter, a white birch with quarter inch thick birch bark is a lot of walking. So to get one tree for one sheet of bark, a big panel of bark, we will test sometimes 50 different trees throughout the region before we find one tree that's of canoe quality. So just any birch bark can't be used. It has to pass a certain test. So just finding quality bark is becoming a major endeavor these days. Our forests have changed so much in my lifetime, and not to mention the change that's happened in my father's lifetime and his father. And so we're on nature's time, and So after that year of harvest, these materials are put away, and usually the canoes are built right around the time the bark comes off. You have all the materials ready, and in the spring of the year, then construction will start. They were pretty expert builders back in the day. No one knows how long it actually took them to construct the birch bark canoe. All I know is that it takes me, I can construct a 16-foot canoe, build it in 6 days. So me and my apprentices, we actually set a record with ourselves. And it's an amazing thing because there's so much work. Birch bark canoe, what I like about birch bark canoe building, it takes me in so many different places of Grandmother Earth. So many different places in Grandmother Earth. The Wabashkiking, the swamp where our medicines grow. It brings us to Zagaiganing, the lakes where our fish live. Mitiguwaking, the forest where the various trees live. And being in part of that and having our moccasins on the ground, we have that connection. We're living that connection. Every day we live that connection. And the birch bark canoe is... it carries culture, and it carries history, and it carries our way of life, and it carries our identity.
You teach this craft, and how are you using this art as a way to teach the history and culture to your students? For example, when you hold up a moccasin, what do you tell your students about what each element means?
I use a type of teaching that I call not teaching culture, but teaching culturally. Teaching culturally is more the way our people traditionally learned. It's by making education three-dimensional. For example, teaching culturally is my eighth graders, I do lots of beadwork too, and I do lots of different art. But anyway, my eighth graders wanted to make a tobacco pouch, okay? So what we did was we started in the fall. We hunted a Wawaskeshi, a deer. We harvested a deer. We brought the hide in the school, and we taught them how to tan buckskin. I taught them how to tan buckskin. We smoked it the old way. Our children learned about what buckskin is, where it comes from, why it's respected. Then we made our patterns. Showed them pattern making, cut the buckskin out. They learned that being able to work with that fiber and cut leather. There's a certain way you cut buckskin. It doesn't cut like factory leather. It has its own feel and its own texture and its own beauty. And so then we make the pouch, okay? After the pouch is made, we go back and we also have tobacco, native tobacco we're growing in our school, so we don't use commercial tobacco when we make an offering to the spirit world. We're teaching tobacco as traditional, it's sacred, it's not for self-gratification. So then this ninsema, this native tobacco, goes into that pouch. Now we not only have a pouch, but we have the story all the way back to Wawaskeshi, what that pouch represents. So our students are in the forest, they're in the classroom, they're in all these different places. And we use our language. Our language is the nucleus of our culture. So this is what I am. I'm a language teacher. So we use our culture in a three-dimensional way to teach Anishinaabemowin back to our people here in our community. Waswaganing, Lac de Flambeau, is very, very strong in our cultural ways. We have our intact fishermen and hunters and basket makers and canoe builders and all these things. But what we've lost was the Ojibwe language associated with all of these things. So working with the elders myself, we've compiled a lot of Anishinaabemowin in these areas so that we won't lose these words and these phrases that belong to those certain cultural events. So
interesting.
And the other thing, that's teaching culturally. But what I talk about birch bark is is to bring an awareness to the people about deforestation and poor forest management in the state of Wisconsin. I've walked in state forests, county forests, natural forests, tribal forests, you know, in the backcountry where we don't see 500 yards off the road, and seeing what's happening, especially to our birch forests. Back in the 90s here in northern Wisconsin, we had a beetle, an insect that was, it was attacking our trees. So I believe they released another insect to kill that insect, and it blew up on them. Pretty soon, the forest sounded alive, like it was getting munched on. You could hear, literally hear it, the insects in the forest. After that happened, pretty soon, I noticed that the tops of our birch trees all over the reservation started to die. We were losing our birch trees. They were dying. And at that time in my life, I wasn't building canoes. And I was with my elder, Ozawabik, and I asked him, check it out, Ozawabik, we're losing our birch trees. Go in, he said. We're not losing our birch trees. Our birch trees are losing us, he said. I said, what do you mean by that, Ozawabik? And he said, you know, back in the day, in the time of my grandmother, he said, Anishinaabe was gifted wigwas, birch bark, by our aunt, by our great uncle, Winnebujou, he said. That was given to us as a gift, and it was told it would always be a covering, and it would be a protector. And Anishinaabe would use it all the way, in all throughout their lives, through certain things, from the cradle board as a baby, all the way to when they take their great journey to the other side. Birch bark is used for baskets. It covers our homes. It does all of these things. We keep our history scratched and pictographed on birch bark. So all of these wonderful things our people use wigwas for. Today, he said, are the birch trees, what are they being used for? He said, toilet paper, he said, and toothpicks. So the spirit of wigwas, he said, is looking at the Anishinaabe and saying, okay, you don't want to use me what I'm for? Then I'm just going to go away. That struck me in a very, very profound way, what that elder told me. So 15 years ago, I started a process of bringing an awareness back to birch bark in my community. And I started to, like the elder was speaking earlier there, about losing things, about not having enough things to sustain it. What I'm talking about is, after doing the research, I found there was only 5 Ojibwe canoe builders left in the Midwest, master builders. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, well, everybody had that craft, because me and my brother both build birch bark canoes. We have four builders in Lac des Flambeaux now. But anyway, so I started that process again. And it, you know, I did a commission with Olympia State University out in Olympia, Washington. I went on the World Canoe Journey, built a birch bark canoe for them, and that was the start of it. And I've done residencies and went to several Native communities and taught canoe culture back, planted that seed in those communities, and canoe culture is coming back. So 15 years ago, there was only 5 builders. Today, Today we have 9.
Wow. It's fascinating to hear from both of you. We only have about 30 seconds left, and Karen Ann, I wanted to ask you, What do you hope to teach people? What kinds of conversations do you hope to spark with your work?
I want people to understand exactly what Wayne has been saying, that the earth is our cradle, the earth takes care of us, and it's our responsibility to live in a way that takes care of the earth. I'm so proud of Wayne, and I'm so grateful to him for all that he has done. And I'm grateful to have a chance to say publicly the respect that I have for Wayne.
Once again, I want to congratulate you both. The work you've produced is absolutely breathtaking, and I'm so grateful that you took the time to share your thoughts with us today. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Once again, thanks to our guests, Karen Ann Hoffman and Wayne Ballier. Our producer is Joy Ratch-Kramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Our on-air producer today is Rob Menser. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, we'll hear the fascinating story of a Cuban-born heart surgeon who, along with his family, escaped Fidel Castro's regime as a child and made Wausau his home. Until then, we're heading out of town.